Welcome, everybody. I'm Chris Sharon. This is the last in a series called After Laura Ingalls. And today's session, as I'll say a little bit more about, is looking forward to what kind of country we want to be and how the work that I've been doing and the work I've been inviting all of you into can help us envision that. I started today, though, with a song from Frank Wallen, who's a Lakota hip-hop artist, I mentioned, I think, yesterday, and I wanted to play a song of his. This is a song called Treaties, and he does two interesting things in the video, in the song. One is he samples the voices of Lakota elders talking about their experiences of the treaties that have been broken, and they say that over 500 years of engagement with white colonists, 500 treaties have been broken with them. And the second thing that I think is interesting is he intentionally steps back to give honor to the elders. So his voice isn't the prominent voice in the song, even though he's the hip-hop artist. So he says about that, that he samples Susan Harjo, Faith Spotted Eagle, and Kevin Glover, centering the voices of these indigenous elders in a song is a great way to show my audience who I learn from and to share knowledge directly from the source. This song is as relevant now as it was 100 years ago when the U.S. government was breaking its treaty rights. It's happening right now, he says, with the Dakota Access and Keystone pipelines being built on treaty land. I hope the song spurs every American citizen who hears it, indigenous or not, to pressure our government to follow its own laws and honor the treaties. This song is about justice. So a beautiful young artist from South Dakota from the Rosebud Reservation, and I just want to lift him up. And even if you're not into hip-hop, you could give him a listen and experience really beautiful, powerful music that's speaking to youth across the world. Hip-hop is, the single most powerful form of youth protest globally. It's gone every place in the world, and it's a powerful musical medium for saying what's wrong with the world and saying that young people are not going to stand for it. They're not going to live in a world like that. That's not all hip-hop is, but it's a really powerful element of hip-hop culture, and Frank really is channeling that directly. So wanted to start there. Here's my opening slide, and what I'm doing as I've gone through this series of sessions is doing some groundwork for a book I hope to write about a series of stories. And the point in writing the book is partly to invite other people to think more deeply and more complex ways about their own stories, especially white people. So it's partly my white story, and it's partly the story of Laura Ingalls Wilder and her family's story, which is also my story, because my great-grandmother, Charlotte, called Lottie, was a double cousin of Laura. They were born in 1867 in Pepin, Wisconsin, and grew up together and moved west together and ended up both settling in South Dakota. So this is a picture of my great-grandma Lottie, who is Laura's double cousin. And she was the mother of my grandma May, who was born in Keystone, South Dakota. And then they moved on to Grable, Wyoming, which is where my dad grew up on a ranch. And so this story of my own life and this historical story of my family, which has become an iconic story about Pioneer Life in America, the Little House on the Prairie series, has sold, I don't know, many tens of millions of copies, 60, 70 million copies. How many of you have read at least one of the books in the Little House on the Prairie series? There you go. So it's a powerful American story, a pioneer story. And then the third reason I'm doing this work is because of what's going on in our country right now. Not just in the last week, although that's profoundly a sort of profoundly poignant and upsetting example of what's going on, But the big thing that's going on that's pushed me to do this project now is the generational shift that's happening in my lifetime from the population of the U.S. being white majority to the population of the U.S. being majority people of color. And that transition has already happened in elementary schools. If you look at the demographics of the country on the level of elementary schools, white children are the minority in the country. And that will soon be the case for the whole population in maybe 10, 15 years. So how is it that especially white people, myself and those of you who understand yourselves to be white in that racial categorization that we use, can help make that transition as a country in just and generous ways? And I think what friends have told me, especially friends of color have told me, is that part of what needs to happen is white people need to do the work of telling their own story more honestly, to tell a truer story of our own families, our own circumstances, so that we can envision a more just future together. And so that's the work I'm trying to do. I'm not an expert really at anything I'm talking about, but it's territory I'm exploring for the sake of trying to write a book about this, what I'm calling my white story, and telling it in a complex way, in a way that interrogates my own experience and tries to tell it more honestly for the sake of this moment that we're in. Hillbilly Elegy, if you've seen that book, is a prominent example of another person writing in that mode, and there are other examples. And I think you don't need to write a book about it. I just think it's an invitation for all of us to be critically reflective about who we are and how we're living in the country. Part of the tension that's happening this week, and we'll dig into it more tonight at the community forum, is the tension that erupted last weekend in Charlottesville with, first of all, a Unite the Right rally that was sponsored by a loose group of white supremacists and neo-Nazis, and so there's a variety of names for it, but this group of protesters went there to protest the plan to take down a statue of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee on a horse in the Central Square in Charlottesville. And as you know, if you've been reading the papers over the past year or two, there's an increasing pressure and willingness to bow to that pressure to remove public symbols of the Confederate era that, for many people, rightly so, represent the denial of the full dignity of African American people. The Confederacy was based on support for the whole system of slavery. So they were there to explicitly protest taking down that symbol. In his response, President Trump really evoked what I've been trying to wonder about as I've gone through this week. He said, you had a group on one side that was bad and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent, and no one wanted to say that, but I'll say that right now. He said this in Tuesday's news conference. And so he's really saying, listen, there's not just a violent side and then everything on the other side is fine. He's trying to portray a kind of moral equivalence to these two sides that came. And it's true, there were the white supremacist neo-Nazi protesters who didn't want the statue to be torn down. And then there were a whole bunch of counter-protesters who came. And that group of counter-protesters were there to say, that is not the country we believe in. A country that has a nostalgia, not only for a time when white people were dominant, but explicitly for a time when African Americans were slaves. That is not our America. Here's a picture of some of my colleagues who were there as clergy leaders, invited by the clergy of Charlottesville to come and to pray and to stand in silent witness against that view of who we should be as a society. Yeah. A priest or a pastor or an imam or a rabbi, someone who's an official leader of a religious community. Yeah. And so they had a broadly interfaith group of faith leaders who were there. One of the things they did was literally just kneel around the square where the statue is and pray. Second, they offered pastoral care and support, water, a listening ear to people who were there protesting and who were hurt some, who were upset by what was happening. Third, they, in a nonviolent protest, interlocked arms and stood at the steps up into the park to try and block the access to the park for the neo-Nazi white supremacist protesters who were coming. And then there was a smaller group of protesters who called themselves anti-fascist protesters, Antifa for short, A-N-T-I-F-A, who have a long history and who have taken on aggressive tactics to seek out and to counter the work of what they consider destructive right-wing neo-Nazi organizations. So they operate independently on local communities, and they came to this gathering to try and shut down this protest that they felt like was upholding values that they don't believe in, and they don't believe anyone should believe in, that they're inhumane. So this morning, this is what Donald Trump tweeted. He's the tweeter in chief, I guess. And they go from bottom to top. Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. You can't change history, but you can learn from it. Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, who's next? Washington, Jefferson, so foolish. Also, the beauty that is being taken out of our cities, towns, and parks will be greatly missed and never able to be comparably replaced. So he's offering an argument for the proponents of keeping the statue of Stonewall Jackson in the center square and other artifacts of the Confederacy like that. So one of the things that we're in the midst of, and I think the election of Donald Trump portrays, is a battle, literally, this was an eruption of a battle over what is the future of our country. How do we see the United States of America? That's the question for today. Brown is the New White is the title of my session, and Brown is the New White is just the demographic fact. Like, this country is becoming majority brown, and there's no stopping it. It's just happening. The question is, how do we as a country, all of us, envision our future together, and especially, how do we, who, as Ta-Nehisi Coates puts it in his book, Between the World and Me, those of us who believe ourselves to be white, how do we envision this future in which we become a minority, in which we have a seat at the table, but no longer get to determine who is and who is not at the table? So that's the question I want to dig into today. This book by Steve Phillips is a couple years old, a year and a half old, something like that. And he basically takes this demographic shift, the facts of this demographic shift in our country, and then asks the question, what does that mean for the changing power of our country? And he's not speaking to me particularly. To others of you who are white, we're a secondary audience for him. His primary audience is this whole group of diverse people of color who are coming into their own as citizens in public life, not just in new immigrant enclaves, but now they're being elected to office. In my own state of Minnesota, we had for the first time a Somali American elected to the state House of Representatives. Ilhan Omar, who's just an incredible young 34-year-old woman and fantastic public speaker. She's very follower on social media. She's so interesting to follow on Twitter or to look at her Facebook page. So all across the country, these communities of color are moving into civic life, into political life, into economic life. 80% of the businesses started by the Somali community in the Twin Cities are owned and run by women. Powerful, powerful civic change that's happening. That's what he wrote this book about. So here's a brief video that just gives him a chance to describe what he's up to with this book, and it kind of frames the space that I want to enter into in the conversation today. Whoops, sorry. Got excited and pressed the wrong button.
Numbers to reshape American politics, to elect presidents and senators, not in 2044, not 10 years down the road, today.
So here's a Census Bureau depiction of the changing demographics. Let me get the buzz out of this speaker here. And it shows on the top where we are, you know, more or less now, 2015. White is the blue. Hispanic is yellow. Then the teal color is black. I don't know what the next one is, red maybe, is Asian. And then the green is multiracial, two plus races. And you can see, actually, every one of the categories of color are growing, and the white one is shrinking dramatically. The bottom one here is 2060. So by 2060, the white population of the U.S. will just be above 40%, like 42, 43%. These are projections, but projections based on the changes that have been happening. So there's some. It's the Census Bureau, so they're basing it on their what they have seen happening as they take the data samples, not just every 10 years, but they do updates in between. So this is a sort of launch into the conversation, the things that I've said and that I've shown. And as a provocative way to get you into conversation with one another about this reality, I'm going to show you, you probably saw it, but I'm going to show you Coca-Cola's commercial that they broadcast during the Super Bowl. How many saw that? A few of you. It's basically a series of pictures of Americans while the song America the Beautiful is sung. You would think, oh, how patriotic, how Coca-Cola. It set off a firestorm of criticism from guess who? Especially white Christian America. Because what they saw in that video was not their dream of the future of America. They saw another dream, which they did not like. And they went to all bunch of hashtags on social media. You know what a hashtag is? Anyone not know what a hashtag is? I'll tell you if you don't. Don't be shy. On Twitter, when you put a hashtag like that and then a word, it allows you to search all the other people who are commenting about that topic. And there were critical hashtags created that became trending topics on Twitter to criticize this ad. What I want you to do is watch this ad, and then my invitation to you afterwards will be to turn to your neighbor and have a conversation about two questions. The first question is, how did you feel when you saw this Coca-Cola depiction of our country? Coca-Cola's opinion is like, this isn't the future of America, this is America right now. This is who we're selling to. You know, they're pragmatic. They're not doing it because they have some gauzy-eyed view of the, you know, they're not thinking of what's God's desired future for America. They're thinking, what's our bottom line? But nonetheless, how did you feel about the video? And then second, what is your dream for the future of the United States? So I want you to watch the video and then
turn to just one person or maybe three. If you get too many, then you can't talk very much. And this is a way to draw out the introverts. So I'll play the video, and then I'll put up the two questions, and I'll have you talk with one another about how you respond to the video and what is your dream for the future of the United States. Let me turn the sound back up. Okay, I'm inviting you to wrap up your conversation. Well, that was in a quiet room. Thanks for engaging the conversation. I'd like to hear a couple of, I'm fine that you had the conversation about how you felt about the video, and I'm not going to ask for responses from that, but I'd like to hear a few people name either what you said or what someone in your group said, if they're okay with you sharing it, about your vision for the future of the United States. And I'm just going to go around in a sweep like this and see if I can have a couple of volunteers from the room to share what they shared about how they envision, what they dream of, what kind of future do you envision for the U.S. Let's start with Carl up here and go this way and see who'd like to share something. Anybody on the upper side, down here, in the back, please. And when you speak, but people generally have said they can hear in this room as long as you use your like almost outside voice.
We both agreed that we would really like to see not just urban, but also rural areas racially diverse.
Thank you. There was a hand over here somewhere. Yeah, please, in the back.
Sam and I were talking here, and it was kind of a different take on this. I personally think as far as the racially diverse, I'm not, you know, I think that's a great thing, actually, and there's really no, you know, way to say you don't really want that. But what we're more concerned about is the divide between the rich and the poor in this country. And the actual automation is taking away jobs. Where is that going to end? Because that's what's really driving a lot of people into poverty or into lower middle class. And what happens then is people just get really angry and start fighting back, whether it's these protests, you know, that are happening. People are just disgusted. We're also tired of the government that doesn't do anything. You know, all they do is argue with each other.
Especially Congress.
Yeah, that's what we'd like to see. I guess I'd like to see that addressed more.
So a dream for the future is not just focusing on the racial ethnic diversity, but also economic equality, right. Not leaving a bunch of people behind while some people get extraordinarily wealthy. And also this this last question that you raised, the last point that you raised. Say that again.
About the government.
Yeah, not an extraordinarily effective government, seemingly in resolving some of these issues or leading. One of the interesting things is if you watch, this is just an aside, but if you read the transcript of President Trump's press conference on Tuesday, all the questions were about Charlottesville and about racial justice, and all of his answers were that weren't about Charlottesville were about job creation. So they said basically would ask him, how do you think your remarks today will help the nation come together amidst this racial divide? And he said, I'm creating jobs. So is it he in a sense completely ignored the racial issues and spoke to the economic issue. So that's interesting that you raised that. Anybody up here want to share about the vision of the future of the country going across the top? How about going across the middle down here? Yeah, please.
We talked about we'd like to see us united as Americans, seeing ourselves as Americans. And one of the images that was missing from this commercial was a naturalization ceremony, which I think would have been incredibly powerful to see the different ethnic and racial groups, but also respect for the heritage communities. And for example, another thing that was missing from the commercial is there was no Satunda Mai parade, there was no Polish festival, and there was no white steeple from New England. And I think we need respect for all of those communities that we are part of and that we cherish, and whether they're racial or geographic. I mean, for example, agricultural, some of us have small town origins, as well as what we are united as a country, hopefully moving forward with a Congress that works.
Great, that's a really interesting vision to raise about particularity. And one of the questions I don't have an answer to, but I'll just name now, is it's a part of my pondering what the future could be for those of us who believe ourselves to be white, is if we quit doing that, how do we describe ourselves? My friend Jennifer Harvey, who I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, does conversations with campus groups, and she'll do this exercise where she says, if you see a group of students going across campus with signs, African Americans, and the signs are some black is beautiful, black power, how do you feel about that? And then she says, and you see a group of Latina students going across campus, and the signs say, si, si puede, and brown power, and that kind of thing. How do you feel about that? And then she says, well, and what if you see a group of white students walking across campus and saying, white power, and white is beautiful? And the tension there is that it's not very simple to see those as equivalents because of the way that white has had this dominant and violent place as a unifier in our country. So if we think about racial ethnic particularity, we have a challenge in rethinking how we think of ourselves, how we tell. In other words, what I'm trying to do is invite us to re-narrate our story. How do we tell our story in a more complex way and not buy into some of the myths and the simplifications of not only our present understanding of ourselves, but our history? So thank you for that.
I will add to that what you just said, though. If the white group had said, power to women, completely different.
That would be absolutely, absolutely. Anybody over here want to share what they were thinking about in terms of their vision for? Yeah, please.
Just thinking about the economic inequality and what Trump said about job creation, I think that what he does, how he came to power, is by appealing to people's racial identity. Mm-hmm. And he did that speaking to white people. He also did that speaking to black people. He went to black churches and spoke to them about their black identity to the Latino community, and he did very poorly at that. But that's his lens, is by encouraging people to view themselves through their racial identity first and foremost. So therefore, a rural white person identifies more with this rich megalomaniac because they're both white than they would be to the Latino farm worker working beside them. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I have seen be successful and what I believe we can do much more of is help people incorporate their class identity and think about their class identity as well, so that they are, so that their identity as white becomes less important, and therefore threats to it become less scary and provoke less of a reaction.
In a sense, a vision in which we're connected with those in which we have a lot in common.
Right.
It's an interesting organizing challenge that's countered by this public ideology of race and how it functions. Yeah.
I was just thinking, because of the comment from over there, that in Yakima, a very vital fruit-growing community, it's the Latinos that make the fruit harvest possible, and in the absence of their labor, you know, there's a lot of agriculture right now that's suffering tremendously. The harvests cannot be collected, and the prices are being driven up, and the political blame falls, interestingly, not where it should, where the labor is disappearing or being made to disappear is probably the better way to put it. There's still I'd like to see a future where the blame is, not good to talk about it this way, but the blame is where it should be, rather than in the myths that persist, like unions bad. Unions aren't bad. They've actually been incredibly helpful to leveling the playing field. Or, you know, workers bad, they're stealing our jobs. Actually, they're not stealing our jobs, they're making our lives more reasonable. So I'd like to see the less myth and more truth to stories.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah. That's very resonant with what I've been trying to explore over the past couple of days. Nancy, did you want to jump in? Allison?
I just was wondering about the language factor.
Yeah.
If people from all different cultures and languages come and decide to not learn English, is that going to be a problem? Do I, as an English-speaking European-American, am I expected in my own country to suddenly learn five different languages so that I can converse with my neighbor? I don't know.
And yet we can flip that a little bit and look to Europe, where perhaps the countries are a little closer together than we are as a nation. And it's very common for an individual to speak four and five different languages,
right.
Not necessarily as a scholar, but just as an individual on the street.
Right.
Perhaps we, as a nation, as a country, might need to expand our ability and maybe think beyond just a single language.
I want to spend the second part of our time exploring one particular problem in getting to that more, if you will, diverse and connected kind of future. And it has to do partly with what you're describing around language. It has to do partly with this theme about economic justice. It has partly to do with the question of race and identity. And it's a question about perception. And it's spelled, some of the stuff I'm drawing from is from this really helpful book, The End of White Christian America by Robert Jones. And he talks about the survey research that he's done on perceptions of issues around racial justice between white people, what white people perceive to be true and what people of color perceive to be true. And one of the key places where, in the last couple of years, partly because of what's been happening in our country, one of the key places where he's asked this question is around perceptions of the police and of the criminal justice system. And this iconic picture from the protests in Baton Rouge is an example of sort of perception questions. When you look at the picture and ask people what they see, which I'm not going to take the time to do right now, but you can just think to yourself, what do I see when I look at this picture? You get quite different responses, and you can see some of that in the survey responses. Leisha Evans is the protester, and I don't know the names of the police officers, but it's hard to tell they're even police officers, frankly, with the gear that they have. But she was a part of the protests and just walked out to basically say, we have a right to march. We have a right to speak. And she was arrested. You can see they're coming with the hand ties and put her hands behind her back and arrested her. Well, here's the first statistical portrayal of the racial perception gap. And one of the interesting things is disproportionate violence against people of color, especially African Americans, and incarceration of people of color, especially African Americans, is not new at all. What's changed is the ubiquity of these and people videoing things that are happening and then posting them on social media, and so many more people seeing, as if for the first time, for white people, African American and other people of color knew this was happening anyway. But you see across here, the top line is the white response, and the response down here is the black response to this question. Blacks and other minorities receive equal treatment as whites in the criminal justice system. And there's just a persistent big gap between the confidence of white people that they'll receive, that blacks and minorities receive equal treatment as whites, and the perception of black people. And so I think that's a question to be asked, and Robbie asked it in terms of perception. Why do white people have the perception that that's true, that blacks and other minorities get the same equal treatment as whites? Here's a second survey response. Recent killings of African American men by police are part of a broader pattern of how police treat African Americans. 73% of African Americans, all African Americans in this survey say, yes, we agree. It's part of a broader pattern of how police treat. White unaffiliated, that means not religiously affiliated. Close to the percentage. But then when you look at white all, and especially white Christian, below 50%. So a real perception gap again here, that's particularly pronounced among white Christians. So that's disturbing. And so Robbie and other survey researchers wanted to figure out sort of how do we get at this perception gap? Why is it that white people don't have the same point of view about these social realities, which if you look at the statistics, it's plain to see that there's systemic bias and way more incarceration of people of color generally and African Americans in particularly, and killing of them by police officers, pulling them over. Philando Castile, who was shot and killed by a police officer a couple blocks from my house in St. Paul, was in his early 40s, and he'd been got his license when he was 19, and he'd been pulled over 52 times by the police, almost always for, like he changed lanes without signaling, or he had a turn signal light out on the back of his car. And I think, I'm 50, and I thought back, how many times have I been pulled over since I got my license when I was 16? You know, maybe 5, 52 versus 5. So the statistics of disproportionate intervention by the police and violence by the police and incarceration are just true. But the perception gap is also true. So he wanted to get at why is that. And so they did what they called a core social network survey. And in this core social network survey, they asked people to think about the circle of people with whom they have in-depth conversations about their life, the people that they trust, that they don't just like say hi at the coffee machine at work, or even maybe get together at a social gathering, but people who they would actually say, hey, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to do with this investment, or I'm trying to figure out where my kids should go to college, or you know, whatever it might be, people that you would have a more in-depth conversation about your values, about your choices, those sorts of things. And what they found was 91% of white folks have are, no, the social circles of white people in general are 91% white. And 75% of white people in the United States have 100% white social circles. And so this is a depiction of that. And they did the same thing with people of color. And what they found was people of color have many more white people in their social circles than white people have people of color in their social circles. And so when you wonder about that, one of the realities then is white people just don't have proximity to the perspectives and the life experiences of people of color, and especially of African Americans. They just don't know. And so that's, I think, a real damning statistic. And it says something that it's not just as the famous saying goes that Sunday morning is the most segregated hour. Our whole lives are still really segregated as a nation, white versus minority. And so living into something different than tribalism, in which there are all these different communities which know themselves but don't know others, would require different daily practices of living. And so that's a place where I want to go now in the last few minutes, thinking about what that would look like. This is Jennifer Harvey, who I mentioned earlier. Her fantastic book is called Dear White Christians, For Those Still Longing for Racial Reconciliation. Very accessible, very practical, and I encourage you to look at it. And she says this: whites tend to become deeply invested in racial justice and anti-racism work only after they become invested in the lives of people of color through experiencing long-term meaningful relationships. Interestingly, the exact same thing has been found as Robbie's done surveys about perceptions of Muslims, perceptions about LGBTQ people. Like, if you don't know them, you're more likely to be biased against them. It's just the fact. So what Jennifer does is she encourages very practical steps that lead to, number one, more truthful understandings of the reality of the sort of history and circumstances of our life and our nation and our communities, and two, repair of what's broken, like actual material repair of the harm that's been done in these broken relationships. And then maybe we'll have a way toward reconciled relationships. She says one of the things that white people want to do, especially white Christians, is quickly go to reconciliation with minority people without, number one, either acknowledging the truth of the harm that is a part of our history or seeking any way materially to repair that harm. And so she really makes the strong argument that reconciliation is a beautiful goal, but it's actually immoral to offer someone reconciliation before you acknowledge the harm and try and repair it. So if we actually want to act on our Christian values in this diversifying country, she says, and she invites that journey. And I want to just put before you, we worked with Jennifer to come up with a series of five concrete steps that individuals and congregations, white Christians, white people in general, but especially white Christians, could do that would help them take steps down this trajectory. And I made copies of the five practices up here, if you want to pick one up on your way out. The first one is learn more about our nation's racial history. And I think of that in terms of understanding my own story in it, which is why I'm doing this project about after Laura Ingalls, to try and understand my piece, my family's piece in the racial history of our nation, which in my case means really looking directly at the horrific relationship we've had with the Native peoples in this country. But other things too. That's not, there was a lynching of a couple of African American men in Duluth, Minnesota. So it's not like lynching of African Americans was just a Southern thing. No, it happened in my state. So learning this history is number one. and not asking someone else to educate you, like taking responsibility yourself. There's lots of resources. And on the sheet, there's a website where this is posted. And connected to the website is a whole bunch of resources if you want really excellent resources for pursuing this. Second is breaking out of white self-segregation. That's the social circle thing that I was just talking about. And how would you break out of that? Well, you can do it a lot of different ways, but it means breaking some habits of where you go, where you shop, who you connect with. It could be breaking where you live. But figuring out what are the patterns of my daily life that could be different, that would introduce me to, put me in proximity to, help me to get to know the life stories of people of color. Number three, educate myself about the hopes, fears, and desires of people of color today. And I think this is really about just diversify. One of the things we've gotten into in our country is echo chambers of news. Who we listen to, who we learn from. And I really intentionally, personally, have expanded my circle of people that I follow and listen to. Joy Reid, for example, is a television commentator, African-American, who I really appreciate. And there's a set of people that I've intentionally sought out to listen to their perspective, hear what they have to say, read what they're reading, because it gets me out of my set of assumptions into really different people's stories and sets of assumptions. It has to do with what I read. So that's third. There's a fantastic couple of movies that came out and won Academy Awards this year. Moonlight is one of them. Fences is another one. So even just going to a different movie than you might otherwise. The fourth one is engage and challenge racism in white social circles. These get tougher as they go down. So when someone makes a racial joke in your family or in your workplace, not just being silent. Silence is complicity, it's permission, it's approval. So figuring out how to practice with others, how to interrupt that. Like there are actually trainers, Jen Harvey is one, there are many others, who do trainings with white people to learn how to be gently disruptive, assertive. This is a dangerous thing. You know what happened in Oregon when the gentleman tried to step in. Very different people, but they tried to step in on the train and interrupt the white guy who was attacking the Muslim women on the train. And he then turned and attacked them, and two of them died. So for Christians, this is actually an invitation to pick up our cross and follow. And it's risky. It is risky. But you can be an advocate in many ways. But willing to, my friend Caitlin, who I work with at Auburn, has done organizing in the South for many years. And she just is totally uninterested in what white people say about their anti-racism. She's like, I don't even care what you say. Just show me what you do. What you do is what I take as the truth about your commitments. So that's tough, but she's full of tough love. She's real. The last one is prepare for public action. This is what that picture I showed you earlier was. These folks. Some of them got hurt. They heard the clergy in Charlottesville say, come help us. We can't respond to this. We're not enough ourselves to respond to this. Come and stand with us. Come and help us. Not just clergy, but faith leaders of all sorts, lay people who are concerned, went and stood in solidarity for the local clergy and faith communities who wanted to say publicly, no. This is not who we are as a community. This is not who we understand ourselves to be as human beings. So preparing for public action means wondering what it means to at some point say, I'm not going to stay on the sidelines. I'm going to go and show up. There's this beautiful sign at the Women's March, and it was an elderly white woman, and she had a sign, and it said, I'm really too old for these kind of marches, but but geez. Like she couldn't, with what was happening, with what Trump had said, she just couldn't be on the sidelines. She had to go. And there are moments for all of us when we have to ask ourselves, can I privately grouse about this? Or do I need to show up? There's a powerful organization calling Stand Up for Racial Justice, SURGE, which is about that. How do white people practice being an ally for people of color? And showing up is a key piece of it. That's time. So the conversations never end in sessions, and our conversations about this won't end in this session, but the session is going to end. So thank you for coming and for engaging.